Today is Wednesday, October the 29th, 2025. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key. Big Tech has been collecting and aggregating your personal data. Do you know how big tech companies and our government are using your personal data? We have been bringing computer news, hardware and software reviews, guest interviews, and news of user group meetings for the past 43 years. The Personal Computer Show is a three-time winner of the prestigious National Computer Press Awards. Our only advocacies are consumerism and the First Amendment. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network, prn.live, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.live on the Internet. Your most sensitive information is now easily accessible to the world. In early September, Medicare contacted almost 1 million beneficiaries about a loss of personal identifiable information related to a vulnerability in third-party software. In other words, your Social Security number, central to filing taxes, applying and maintaining credit, and receiving certain U.S. government benefits is very likely available to hackers and would-be criminals for exploit. And if it isn't yet, the unfortunate reality is that another data breach will inevitably change that. You don't have to wait for trouble to find you. However, you can take several steps to minimize the possibility of identity theft or fraud in your name, since other details like your full name, birth date, and residence are also likely loose in the wild. Confirming if your information was leaked can be helpful. Generally, you shouldn't volunteer your personal data to websites claiming to check if you were caught in a data breach, especially if you don't know who runs them. But several have been vetted, with a couple dedicated specifically to the national public data breach and don't require sensitive information for verification. They are NPD Breach Check, with the website of NPD for National Public Data .pentester.com. I'll repeat that. NPD.pentester.com. And the other outfit is National Public Data Breach Check and Search, with a website NPD Breach. That's NPDBREACH.com. The NPD Breach Check site returns multiple listings linked to phone name, state, and birth year you input, while the National Data Public Data Breach Check and Search site retains more granular results based on phone name plus zip code and Social Security number or phone number. If you're still wary of these sites or want broader, more long-term monitoring, you can also get notification through Google's Dark Web Report service and some paid antivirus subscriptions. Have I Been Pwned, PWNED, is also an excellent resource for data breach notifications, though your email address must be part of the lost data for it to work. Freezing your credit costs nothing and keeps fraudsters from opening credit cards and loans in your name. A smart move when your full name, date of birth, and Social Security number are floating around on the Internet. You must perform the security freeze with each credit bureau. In the United States, the three major ones are Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion. For thoroughness, you can also freeze your report with Innovis, that's Innovis, a smaller fourth credit bureau. Once frozen, your credit reports become only available to you. If you need to allow a third-party credit check, like when renting a new apartment or opening a new line of credit, you can temporarily lift the freeze through the Equifax, Experian, or TransUnion websites or through their phone lines. You'll need the PIN issued to you in order to request the temporary lift. While dealing with your credit reports, you should also have a look at them for any fraudulent activity. You can do so weekly through the official website annualcreditreport.com or request paper copies once per year through the phone or by mail. If you spot inaccurate details, you can dispute them. And if you think you see signs of identity theft, you can report it and begin remediation. Tax return frauds can be a serious headache. Fortunately, the Internal Revenue Service allows you to prevent other people from fraudulently filing in your name, even if you don't need to send in a return. If you request an identity protection PIN, that's your IP PIN, any filed return must include the 6-digit PIN for it to be processed. Most taxpayers will need to request a new PIN each year, unless you've been the victim of tax-related identity theft. If so, you should be already automatically receiving a new IP PIN each year from the IRS. If you forget your IRS identity protection PIN, the IRS has methods to help you retrieve it. You can also store the info in a good password manager. And if you're nervous about cloud-based services, you can use one that saves your data to a local hard drive or flash drive. Like with credit, a file exists on you about your banking account activity. And if someone begins opening fraudulent accounts in your name and runs them into the ground, banks may not want to do business with you in the future. You can prevent becoming blackballed by also placing a security freeze with Chex Systems, that's CHEXSYSTEMS, the main company used by banks to verify if you are a worthy customer. Once in place, only you can access your report. To temporarily lift the freeze, like when applying for a new bank account, you can make your request online, using the PIN issued to you when the freeze first went into effect. Amazon launched Help Me Decide to help you decide what to buy. Amazon launched Help Me Decide, a tool that uses generative AI to analyze your buying habits. And then if you're stuck on what particular item to splurge on, it will just make the decision for you. Help Me Decide uses AI to analyze your browsing history and preferences to recommend the right product for you with just one tap. The tool helps customers pick the right product quickly. The feature will present itself as a pop-up in the top right corner of your screen if you've been scrolling just a little too long for a particular product. Amazon says if you decide to use it, the feature will, like the e-commerce giant's other automated features, use algorithms to analyze your buying activity. It then supposedly selects the product that is right for you. Lest you think that Amazon will push you towards more expensive items, the company promises that it will provide you with a variety of price tiers, including an upgrade pick and a budget option. Who knows whether they will be trustworthy or not? Help Me Decide saves you time by using AI to provide product recommendations tailored to your needs after you've been browsing several similar items, giving you confidence in your purchase decision, says the Vice President of Personalization at Amazon. Help Me Decide continues to build on our commitment to use AI to improve the customer experience by creating tools that make shopping easier and more enjoyable. In some sense, this is, yes, convenient, in that the hours that you might typically spend scanning Amazon and trying to decipher the difference between 10 nearly identical products can now be greatly reduced. At the same time, it can't help but feel like yet another step down the dumbing down process ladder that we are all collectively descending. AI can now write emails for you and read them to you. It can compose a message to a Tinder date and tell you what to say when you're actually on the date. And yes, it can decide what you want to buy, and if you program an AI agent correctly, could buy it for you. To be clear, no one said AI is good at doing any of those things, but it can do them. America is the home of the mindless consumer, a nation of cash-hungry consumers who, as George Carlin once put it, we are mindless consumers trained to spend money we don't have on things we don't need. And it's true that buying stuff, especially buying stuff online, can be a pretty mindless activity. Well, now the few mental faculties it does require to buy stuff online will be cleanly automated away with a new artificial intelligence option from Amazon. In my humble opinion, If you need help to decide what you want to buy, the immediate answer is you don't need it. And what if you just want to browse to see what's available, to see what's new? You're not ready to buy, but you just want to see what's available and what it is. Would this application from Amazon give you the incentive to purchase rather than browse shopping? IBM shows quantum computing can run on off-the-shelf AMD processors. IBM has successfully demonstrated that AMD's conventional chips can run a quantum computing error correction algorithm. The breakthrough marks a major step in quantum computing, showing that advanced quantum operations can work on accessible, affordable hardware, accelerating commercial adoption. Quantum computing just took a big step toward everyday use. IBM has found a way to run a key quantum error correction algorithm on standard AMD chips. This experiment shows quantum power can work with affordable, widely available processors. Why error correction matters in quantum computing? Quantum computers process information using qubits. These qubits are powerful but unstable. Small disturbances can cause massive calculation errors. Error correction algorithms fix this problem, keeping quantum operations accurate. IBM's breakthrough shows that this correction can happen on normal hardware instead of only on costly quantum-specific systems. How IBM's experiment worked. IBM's research used an AMD Field Programmable Gate Array, or FPGA. It's a flexible chip type that can be reprogrammed for specific tasks. IBM's algorithm ran in real time, 10 times faster than required. This level of speed means quantum systems can now handle complex problems without being slowed by corrections. It's a leap toward commercial quantum systems. The algorithm's success could speed up the path to commercial quantum computing. IBM aims to launch its Starling quantum computer by 2029. Completing this step a year ahead of schedule boosts its progress toward that goal. Running quantum algorithms on affordable chips also make it easier for developers and businesses to experiment with quantum tools earlier. It's a competitive race with tech giants. IBM is competing with Google and Microsoft, both pushing boundaries in quantum technology. Google recently revealed its own algorithm breakthrough. IBM's advantage now lies in making quantum computing practical with conventional components. That gives it an edge in scaling real-world applications faster. What does this mean for the future? This advancement may make quantum computing more accessible. You could soon see quantum-powered applications that don't rely on massive, expensive hardware. It opens new possibilities for industries like materials science, cryptography, and AI. IBM's demonstration shows that quantum innovation isn't just about power, it's also about practicality. Anthropic bets big on Google's TPUs to expand its AI power. The global AI race just gained new fuel. Anthropic has joined hands with Google Cloud to access over 1 million Tensor Processing Units, or TPUs. The partnership gives the company a massive compute advantage, with more than 1 gigawatt of processing capacity expected by 2026. The latest collaboration builds on Anthropic's ongoing partnership with Google. It signals another major move in the growing cloud competition to secure AI compute power. The deal, reportedly worth tens of billions of dollars, gives Anthropic the infrastructure needed to train large and smarter AI models at scale. By tapping into Google's TPU clusters, Anthropic ensures its models can process data faster while optimizing energy use. More compute means faster model development and greater performance for its AI products. This partnership is not just about size. It's also about strategy. Anthropic is deliberately spreading its compute needs across multiple chip makers instead of relying on a single vendor. Currently, the company uses Google's TPUs, Amazon's Trainium chips, and NVIDIA's GPUs for different workloads. This balanced approach helps control costs while maintaining flexibility. It also safeguards against downtime if one provider faces outages or supply issues, such as the recent AWS disruption that affected several services worldwide. Google's Tensor processing units are purpose-built for AI workloads like training large language models. Unlike general-purpose GPUs, TPUs handle matrix-heavy computations more efficiently, offering better performance per watt. By securing dedicated TPU access, Anthropic positions itself to compete directly with other AI giants that rely heavily on NVIDIA's hardware. It also allows a company to run larger experiments without hitting GPU supply constraints, which have been a constant challenge across the industry. The Anthropic Google deal follows a broader trend among AI firms to diversify their compute sources. AMD, for instance, recently partnered with Oracle to deploy 50,000 AI chips in data centers starting next year. As AI demand surges, no single chip maker can meet the world's training needs alone. By building multi-cloud, multi-chip strategies, companies can scale faster, reduce dependency, and optimize workloads based on each chip's strengths. This collaboration reinforces Google's cloud's position as a serious player in the AI infrastructure, while NVIDIA remains the undisputed leader in GPU supply. Google's TPUs give AI firms like Anthropic another path to scale their innovation. For developers and researchers, this means faster model iterations, better cost efficiency, and potentially shorter training times. For the industry, it shows that compute diversity is becoming essential for AI growth. Anthropic's decision to join forces with Google is more than a hardware upgrade. It's a statement about the future of AI development. Compute access now defines innovation speed, and Anthropic is ensuring it doesn't hit the brakes. By balancing compute power across Google, Amazon, and NVIDIA, Anthropic is preparing for the long game, one where flexibility, performance, and reliability drive the next wave of AI breakthroughs. Is ChatGPT Atlas safe? ChatGPT Atlas is a new AI-powered web browser developed by OpenAI that integrates ChatGPT directly into the browsing experience, allowing users to receive real-time assistance while surfing the web. OpenAI's ChatGPT Atlas brings AI browsing with real-time summaries and task automation, while convenient, security risks like hidden prompt injections and data exposure exist. ChatGPT Atlas is designed to enhance the web browsing experience by incorporating the capabilities of ChatGPT, OpenAI's conversational AI. This browser allows users to perform tasks, search for information, and receive assistance without needing to switch between tabs or applications. It is built on the Chromium platform, similar to other popular browsers like Google Chrome, and supports most Chrome extensions, making it easy for users to transition from their current browsers. OpenAI's ChatGPT Atlas brings the power of AI directly into your browser, from summarizing web pages to booking appointments. It promises smarter and more efficient browsing, but with innovation comes risk. Security researchers are raising alarms about hidden instructions that could expose your sensitive data. Tech professionals, developers, and everyday users need to understand these risks before diving in. ChatGPT Atlas is not just another browser. It integrates ChatGPT into a convenient sidebar. Users can ask AI questions about web pages in real time, use an AI agent to automate tasks like planning events or booking appointments, recall past searches and browsing history to get personalized suggestions. This puts Atlas in direct competition with traditional browsers like Google Chrome, as well as emerging AI browsers such as Perplexity's Comet. The difference? Instead of scrolling through search results, users get actionable insights instantly, all within the browser window. If you are a tech professional exploring AI productivity tools, a developer or student learning AI integration, or even a casual user seeking smarter browsing, Atlas is relevant. However, if your work involves sensitive data, it's crucial to understand the potential security implications. AI-powered agents can access detailed browsing histories and session data, making privacy awareness more important than ever. Despite the risk, Atlas offers tangible benefits: time-saving automation. AI can summarize pages, schedule tasks, or research products efficiently. Personalized browsing. Memory features allow the browser to track past interactions and suggest relevant content. Actionable insights. Instead of sifting through multiple tabs, the AI provides curated information instantly. The convenience is appealing, but it also highlights the importance of understanding how much access you grant to AI agents. Cybersecurity researchers have flagged a type of threat known as prompt injection attacks. In these attacks, AI agents may execute hidden commands embedded in web pages. Sensitive data such as passwords, two-factor authentication codes, or emails could be exposed. The AI could inadvertently act on instructions not intended by the user. ChatGPT Atlas represents the next generation of AI-integrated browsing, combining productivity with personalized insights, but with powerful AI comes responsibility. Tech enthusiasts and casual users alike must weigh convenience against security. OpenAI unveiled another chip supply deal, this time with Broadcom, which is working with OpenAI to develop a custom-made artificial intelligence chip for the ChatGPT creator. That makes three such chip supply deals OpenAI has unveiled in less than a month, which includes NVIDIA and AMD. These three arrangements collectively aim to create a total of 26 gigawatts of chip capacity over several years. Each of the semiconductor companies involved in the deals, NVIDIA, AMD, and now Broadcom, is due to start delivering chips to OpenAI by the second half of 2026, which is shaping up to be a monumentally important date for the AI firm. The way Altman and OpenAI president Greg Brockman put it in a video about the Broadcom deal released, they need this extra capacity to meet demand for their services. The current AI infrastructure build-out requires a lot of companies, a lot of countries, a lot of industries to come together. Companies including Oracle, CoreWeave, AMD, NVIDIA, ARM, Google Cloud, and Microsoft are working to supply either chips or server capacity for OpenAI. SoftBank, which owns most of ARM, is also helping put up much of the money OpenAI needs. And of course, a bunch of other private equity firms and investors are involved one way or the other on the financing end of the industry's broader AI build-out. Any hiccup could cause a seizure that could ripple across the financial system. There are other ways of handling the demand and supply crunch. OpenAI could take away ChatGPT's free tier and require everyone to pay. That would likely depress demand by causing people to think more seriously about how much they really need to ask ChatGPT to help write an email or to use a Sora video service to generate a silly clip for TikTok. The vast majority of OpenAI's 800 million weekly users don't pay, which must unnecessarily inflate usage and add to demand for computing capacity. Altman noted in the video that every 10x improvement in OpenAI services is followed by a 20x increase in demand. Of course, OpenAI won't do away with its free tier while rivals like Google's Gemini still have one. Both companies are trying to get people hooked on the service so that later they can either start charging or introduce ads or other ways of making money from a big group of non-paying users. The strategy makes sense for other tech products, but it doesn't work so well when the entire economy is being turned upside down to ensure there is enough data center capacity to serve everyone who wants to use AI. The best way to understand the real level of demand for any product is to see what price people are willing to pay for it. That holds as true for AI as for anything else. Presenting the IT Pro Series with Benjamin Rockwell.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we talk about computers, the workplace, and a lot of the interactions that you might come across there. Andrew asked, why do information technology people sometimes seem burned out or short in their replies? And I'll tell you that it actually may be partly that, and it may be something that I have recognized this in some of my coworkers over the years. And when we say years, we're talking a long time. This is something that I'm gonna do a parallel because it's an easy one for people to check out on. I can't remember which streaming service it is, but there's a TV show called The Good Doctor, and I'm going through a rewatch of this, and the main character is this doctor that has autism. And I'll tell you, so many people in the IT field are, they're somewhere close to the spectrum, sometimes very deeply onto the spectrum. And one of the things that we can see out of this, or any one of the many other autism-related TV shows or movies, don't think Rain Man, think a little bit lighter on the scale. But you want to think about the fact that sometimes these answers are going to be short. They're going to be kind of a clipped response. This is just a matter of they believe they've provided all of the information that's needed. They're not over talkers. Well, sometimes they are. I know I am. I've got a radio show. I'm going to talk a lot. But you've got the idea there. Sometimes they give out just a specific amount of information. They answer the question you've asked, but they don't give all of the details. And this isn't because they are necessarily annoyed at you. They think the job is done, and they do have a workload. All of the different folks in IT have usually a fairly heavy workload. So I want you to make sure you understand. I want to make sure you understand this. This is not at any point in time level of personal. Most of the folks in IT, they don't mean anything by this. Okay, they may be, they may think they've answered the question. They may be in a triage mode. And this triage mode is a very big thing all the way throughout IT. If the server is down, the niceties are going to be the first thing to go. They're going to say yes, no. They're going to be a little bit more demanding. They're not going to do the usual please and thank you. I've caught myself doing this. A matter of, okay, we've got a fire. We need to put this out. You do this, you do that, you do this, you do that. You know, pointing at four different people and directing them and going, we got to put this fire out. I'll tell you, when the fire engine pulls up in front of your house and the chief gets off of the truck and he starts telling people what to do, you don't care if he says please or thank you. He is going to be directing everything. He's handling a big, huge fire scene. And at times, IT is going to do the same thing. Again, not personal. So, you know, this is going to happen. Now, along the way, I want to suggest a couple of things for you. A matter of how you deal with the folks in IT is going to really set things in a different level. a different framing is always going to be a little bit better. You treat them with a little bit of empathy. You know, one of the things, I know some people approach me and they go, hey, I know you're slammed. If you can just do what you can, if you can, I would appreciate any time you can spare on this. This changes the whole vibe of the message to me. And I've had people say this in a variety of different ways to me and to my coworkers. And they approach this from that different soft approach. And I'll tell you, I actually, the people who come to me and say stuff like that, I actually prioritize that. And I actually treat them personally on a different level, a higher level. And, you know, anybody who comes up to me and, you know, they say, hey, you know what? I was just by the I was just by the snack machine, and I thought I'd bring you a candy bar because I know you run low blood sugar sometimes. And I'm like, oh, don't tempt me. Don't tempt me at all. But they come along and say, hey, when you get a chance, if you could drop by my desk, I'm going to need you probably for about 30 minutes to explain this problem. And I know it'll take some time, but as soon as you get a chance, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to drop everything. Hey, they bribed me with a candy bar. That's great. Now, it's not quite to that extreme, but you get the idea there. You go in that approach of approaching people, and this actually can apply to everybody. You approach them with that soft approach instead of that demanding approach, and it changes the world. And I'll tell you, IT is even more so, because everybody comes to us feeling that their issue is urgent and you've got to deal with this right away. You've got to drop everything. And that constant pressure takes a toll on all of us. So I want you to think about kind of a reverse kind of customer service. Yes, you're the customer, but giving a wave of understanding to anybody in information technology can calm the storm on both sides of this equation, and it can make things just so much better. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Real-time voice deepfakes are here. Are you safe? Cybersecurity experts are sounding the alarm. Real-time voice deepfakes are no longer science fiction. With advances in AI, anyone's voice can now be mimicked in real time, opening doors to fraud, phishing, and corporate espionage. What was once a futuristic concern has become a present-day cybersecurity threat. Unlike pre-recorded deepfakes, real-time systems generate speech on the fly, with just a few seconds of audio. AI can replicate someone's tone, inflection, and speaking style, convincingly enough to fool even trained listeners. These systems are being weaponized in live calls, enabling scammers to impersonate CEOs, bank officials, or IT administrators with alarming realism. Financial fraud, social engineering, and breaches of trust are on the rise. This is not just an issue for cybersecurity experts. Anyone working in digital communication or AI development is at risk. Developers and students exploring generative AI need to understand both the potential and the ethical boundaries of this technology. Modern attacks are increasingly sophisticated, and even advanced verification systems struggle to detect live deepfakes. As these tools become widely accessible, awareness, detection, and prevention are critical. To protect yourself and your organization, verify callers. Never rely solely on voice recognition for identity confirmation. Always use multi-factor authentication to validate sensitive communications. Use AI detection tools, as emerging platforms can analyze voice patterns and flag suspicious real-time activity. Train the staff and peers, and also have regular training to help employees spot unusual tone changes, robotic speech, or inconsistencies in core behavior. keep software updated. Outdated systems are frequent entry points for attacks. Regular updates and patch management are essential. Learn and experiment ethically, and developers can safely explore open source AI deepfake detection libraries to understand manipulation methods and strengthen defenses. Many banks are adopting AI-powered voice biometrics to detect fraudulent calls. Educational tech programs worldwide are adding mandatory modules on ethical AI development and deepfake prevention. Enterprises are investing in real-time anomaly detection systems to counter AI-generated voice threats. Real-time voice deepfakes are not just a tech curiosity. They are a serious cybersecurity challenge. As AI continues to evolve, the ability to detect and prevent manipulation becomes a vital skill for every digital professional. Staying informed, practicing ethical AI development, and promoting awareness across teams are the first lines of defense against this growing threat. Upskill today, because tomorrow's AI fraud may already be speaking in your voice. PC computer sticks, the pocket-sized powerhouses of modern computing. Back in 2015, Intel introduced the PC Compute Stick, a groundbreaking device that promised to put the power of a desktop computer in your pocket. Today, several manufacturers, including ASUS and Lenovo, produce their own versions, all following the same principle: compact, portable, and capable computing. A compute stick is one of the smallest forms of a personal computer, weighing just a few ounces. These mini PCs can run full desktop operating systems such as Windows or Linux. Simply plug the stick into any display with an HDMI port, and you'll instantly transform it into a functional PC. Despite their small size, compute sticks can handle everyday computing tasks, from browsing the web and streaming media to editing documents and checking email. To make the experience more comfortable, you can pair them with a foldable Bluetooth keyboard and touchpad, many of which fold down to fit in a pocket-sized travel kit. Compute sticks connect through an HDMI port, which transmits the video signal to the display. While some displays may provide limited power through HDMI, most compute sticks draw power via a USB or USB-C adapter, similar to how smartphones charge. This setup allows the device to run continuously without relying on a battery, keeping the design lightweight and efficient. The concept of a take-anywhere PC is appealing for both business and personal use. With a common stick, you can travel without a bulky laptop and still have access to your full desktop environment. Simply plug the stick into a monitor or TV, whether you're in a hotel, Airbnb, or conference room. Connect a wireless keyboard and mouse, and you're ready to work or play. This portability also offers enhanced security. Instead of logging into public computers, travelers can carry their own personal workstation, maintaining privacy and data protection. Because compute sticks run full desktop operating systems, your account logins, passwords, and files remain stored securely on your own device. You may have already encountered compute sticks without realizing it. They often power digital information kiosks, airport check-in terminals, and restaurant ordering displays. Their small size, fanless design, and low power consumption make them ideal for such fixed-use environments where space is limited and silent operation is preferred. Businesses also use compute sticks for digital signage, point-of-sale systems, and light data terminals. They can be hidden neatly behind monitors or inside display enclosures, reducing clutter while maintaining reliable operation. While compute sticks are impressive in portability, they come with hardware limitations. Most feature 2 to 8 gigabytes of RAM and low-power processors such as Intel Atom or Celeron chips. This makes them unsuitable for heavy workloads like gaming, video editing, or complex multitasking. They are best suited for lightweight tasks and dedicated applications that don't demand high performance. When portability meets practicability, tablets offer portability, but they often lack full desktop applications and multi-monitor support. Laptops provide computing power, but are heavier and bulkier. Compute sticks strike a balance. They bring the desktop experience to any screen, offering flexibility and convenience in a compact form. For travelers, remote workers, or small businesses, compute sticks provide an affordable and portable computing solution. They can turn any HDMI-equipped display into a capable PC for productivity, media streaming, or digital signage. A PC compute stick is not meant to replace high-end workstations or gaming rigs. Instead, it fills a unique niche, delivering a secure, portable, and capable desktop experience that fits in the palm of your hand. Whether you're movies in a hotel room, running a kiosk at a retail store, or carrying your personal desktop in your pocket, compute sticks prove that sometimes big things really do come in small packages. Windows 11 PC has an emergency shutdown feature. Emergency restart is a last resort method that forcefully resets your computer when it's stuck in a loop. It's a GTK, meaning good to know, helpful feature. To access emergency restart, press the Control plus Alt plus Delete key on your Windows PC. A pretty normal action. However, this time, hold down the Control key and click the power button in the bottom right corner of the screen. This action leads to a message on screen stating that you're attempting an emergency restart, adding click OK to immediately restart. Any unsaved data will be lost. The statement concludes, use this only as a last resort. Click OK, and your computer will turn off and back on as normal. The difference between this emergency method and a regular restart is this an action of last resort? The method is an alternative to a hard reset. The technique is the closest thing to holding down the on-off button on your PC without having to press it. This emergency restart is useful when your computer may have frozen to the point where nothing goes through and it doesn't respond to anything other than Control-Alt-Delete. The method is also helpful on laptops lacking a physical power button. There aren't any drawbacks to using emergency restart. This method is a last-ditch effort for certain situations, although nothing stops you from using it as often as you want. If you want another method, launch the command prompt and type shutdown/R to restart your machine. Instructions for other shutdown methods can be found on Microsoft's Learn website. Presenting Technology Chatter with Benjamin Rockwell and Marty Winston.
Marty Winston joins me now. And Marty, hey, I was just reading Fortune Cookie. Got Chinese food for dinner. And I'll tell you, this fortune that comes up here, meetings, can it really be live if everybody's half dead? And you came to mind right away.
Well, thanks so much.
We've been talking so much about meetings recently, and you'll have some interesting stuff to share with us in the future here.
Oh, but, yeah. Anytime you want to do it. We went live with beam4k.com earlier today.
Okay.
Now, earlier today is in the past for most of you folks. But, it happens to be the coincidence of this session. Zoom fatigue has shown up for years in research. And if you think about it, your meeting schedules, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One hour meeting, inhale, 2 hour meeting, 1 hour meeting, exhale. Isn't that what your day's like?
It's kind of like that. It is 1 hour meeting, a 20-minute meeting, followed immediately by another 20 to 30 to 40-minute meeting. And then throughout the day, average day is about 8 to 10 meetings for me. It's nonstop.
You're not alone.
Oh, yeah.
You are not alone.
Yeah.
And now, to what extent are your meeting minutes all useful minutes?
You mean the time that I spend in the meeting? Is it useful to me for my job?
Right.
It depends on the meeting, but I'll say about half of the time. There are meetings which I'm drawn into, which I'm there as an observer, and there are other meetings which I lead. So, you know, it's 50-50.
All right. So if you could lead a meeting and make everything happen more quickly, you'd get out of it as soon as you could, or would the meeting itself stretch itself?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So there's so many factors and so much credible third-party research that most people haven't seen yet. One thing that comes up, about a third of everybody's time in a meeting is wasted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if you take a look at the people who are in meetings, it's not the admin. It's not the line worker. Mm-hmm. About the lowest level is manager and goes up through top execs. And it turns out the higher your rank in the business, the more time you spend in meetings.
Mm-hmm.
One of the best collections of data, and I was able to apply four different measurements against each other. In an average company,
yeah,
the salary value of time wasted in meetings is $29,900 per employee per year.
Okay. Yeah.
It's
going to depend on who's in there and all of that. But yeah, it can rack up pretty quick.
Yeah. Most meetings don't have agendas, or the agendas read something like usual Tuesday meeting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Most meetings don't have anybody trying to make it shorter. The meetings are scheduled for default. The number one most popular, and this is actuarial data, the number one most popular duration for an online meeting is 30 minutes. The number two mm-hmm. most popular is 60 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think it's a coincidence that when you go into one of the meeting apps or into one of the calendar apps to schedule a meeting, that they default to 30 and 60 minutes?
Oh, yeah. No, very, very true. Yeah. And not everybody arrives on time, and sometimes the meeting goes way over or way under, but then you've allotted so much time in your day. It can be disruptive,
But you're sedentary. You're not getting up and moving. Your blood isn't flowing. It's not exactly good for your energy.
You're
rushing a meal at your favorite vending machine instead of having something you brought from home or something from a counter down the street. You don't have time to get away. You've unlocked the clock. If you're in the Pacific time zone and your headquarters is in Eastern time, you may have to start your meeting schedules at 6. And the other way around, you may not be out of meetings until 11 or 12 at night.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you know, who's going to help you if you're dealing with somebody in Europe or the across the Pacific? It's in Asia, your day is shot. Zoom fatigue, online meeting fatigue is real. It's measurable. It's been found in research. And the sad thing is neither meeting participants nor the organizations holding the meetings are doing very much to control, contain, discipline, or otherwise manage any of it.
Sure.
Yeah, so your Chinese fortune cookie is absolutely right.
You know, we go to, the big meeting that I lead every day. We did numbers on it, and the short number for that meeting that runs under 30 minutes, the easy number is somewhere around $6,500 per day. And it can easily climb up from there, depending on how many people are on there and some of our guesstimates of how much people are getting paid and stuff like that.
Absolutely. And let me also mention that lack of brain back burner time to think about what you've gone over in the meeting.
Oh, yeah. Oh.
Has hurt not only the fatigue of individuals, but creativity is down, which means competitiveness is not the sharp edge anymore. It's hard to be live if everybody's half dead.
As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell. That's Marty Winston.
Thank you, Benjamin, and thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, Connecticut Tri-State Region. Log on to the club website for more information on remote meeting ID. Tech Ed Connect meets Tuesday, November the 4th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Hybrid meeting. Meeting at the Scarsdale Public Library, 54 Olmsted Road, Scarsdale, New York, and online virtual meeting via Zoom. Their website is techedconnect.org. Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, November the 7th. Meeting time is 8 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Jitsi, and the website is acgnj.org. The King's Byte Computer Club meets Tuesday, November the 11th. Meeting time is 5:30 p.m. Brooklyn Heights Public Library, Cranberry Meeting Room, at 286 Cadman Plaza West in Brooklyn, New York. Phone number is 347-278-7320. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, November the 13th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom, and the website is nyacc.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, November the 14th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is limac.org. The Brookdale Computer Users Group meets Thursday, November the 27th. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. The website is bcug.com. Remember to reset your clocks 1 hour back. Daylight saving time ends on November the 2nd, 2025 at 2 a.m. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.live, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.live on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch, and on behalf of Michael Horowitz, Benjamin Rockwell, Mark Brownstein, and Marty Winston, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy. Until we meet again, same time, same station next week.